You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast, with a slightly altered intro. Skip Bayless, ascending the throne to the intro.
And then I thought you were going to say, welcome to First Take, because you were in that mode for
a hot
second.
Exactly. First Takedown. You just heard Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist, back in New York. Hi, Kate. Welcome.
Hi, Chad.
And Neil Payne, a returning hero. Couldn't resist, couldn't stay away, or maybe it was just he couldn't take more than 1 week of vacation at a time. Neil, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's not clear which, but I'll play the returning hero part. Thank you for having me back.
And I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Chad Matlin, senior editor at 538. You're listening to Hot Takedown, our podcast about the week in sports narratives and, you know, some data that may or may not disprove them. So on today's show, we're going to talk about the NFL draft, Mariota, Winston, etc. Is obsessing about the draft even worth it? Then there appears to be a boxing match that's going to happen this weekend. We're going to talk about that, discuss Floyd Mayweather's violent past, boxing's questionable future. And then ESPN the Magazine's Pablo Torre joins us to talk about what happens when athletes go broke, which is something that Pablo's written a lot about. And of course, Significant Digits, Allison McCann will swing through and talk to us, I think, about some NBA playoffs. But first, Jody Avirgan has been released from the shackles of the studio to come talk to us. Last week, we talked about the NBA draft and how to fix it. And then, Jody, you wrote a post on 538, and what happened next?
Right, so you guys mentioned a few of the different ideas out there for fixing the NBA draft and disincentivizing teams from tanking to try and get a better pick. And we decided to, on the site, crowdsource people's ideas for how they would change the draft structure and stop tanking. And, you know, we posted a little form saying, what's your name? Where are you from? What's your crazy idea? Thinking, oh, we'd get maybe a couple dozen responses and then we'll be able to follow up on them. We got, at the current count, we have over 7,000 responses.
Whoa.
Wow.
And I have to say, these are like thesis level plans for how to fix the NBA draft, along with all sorts of data and projections about how it would work and analysis of how it would have worked in past years. I'm holding in my hand a bound copy of one of these plans that someone came to our office and dropped off for us. It's like nine pages long.
He called Nate Silver on the phone from the lobby, and Nate let him up. And he came in and said, and was very polite, very nice. Another senior editor and I met him at the elevator, and he said, hi, are you guys the ones who were responsible or who are in charge of taking ideas for fixing the NBA draft?
And
he said NBA teams have looked at it before and that he would love to submit it.
People are emailing me like PDF attachments because the Google form is like too small to accept their data. So we're getting a lot of ideas. I think we've tapped into something here.
A nerve.
Yes, and now it's my turn to wade through all of these. But, you know, there are actually some really interesting ideas in there. And we'll continue to follow up on the podcast and on the site. But, you know, they fall into like a few basic categories like the wheel, which we talked about last week, and then also like a playoffs for the teams that don't make the playoffs. But then there are also some really weird ideas, which I like. One person suggested that teams in the lottery buy futures on the record of other teams.
So, oh, like, I love this.
Yes.
Neil, you guys would like Neil this. I don't this. Know what's happening.
Wait, hold on. I actually can put this in real language, okay. I think. So if you're the worst team, you would get to bid first on which other team you think will have the worst record the next year. So it's not about your record. It's about which.
So you can't pick yourself.
You can't pick yourself. There's also, don't worry, there are plenty of footnotes and caveats to this plan. But anyway, so there's some really inventive stuff out there. There's also some kind of maybe my favorite one so far is someone wrote and just said, hey, if we just get rid of the NBA, this won't be an issue. And I was like, oh, why didn't we think of that?
That's good. That's good.
Like,
is that nihilist? Fatalist? Yeah.
It's a little bit of like the baby with the bathwater situation happening.
So here's the plan. We're going to keep taking these. You can go to 538.com. You'll find a link that says, what's your plan to fix the NBA draft? Submit yours if you haven't so far. What's the difference between 7,000 and 8,000? Why not? Go ahead. Submit yours.
So you want everybody to come here in person, right, and drop them off?
No. And then we will go through those, and we'll pick a few that we really like, discuss them on the show over the coming weeks. And then the final plan is we're going to pick an official Hot Takedown endorsed plan. We're going to print it out on fancy paper. We're
even fancier than the one delivered to us.
And let's invite Adam Silver.
And we're going to send it to Adam Silver. Or invite him.
Or we'll show up in person unprompted and then deliver it to him.
Yes.
And we will deliver this to Adam Silver's desk and say, you know what? We got this. It's taken care of. Go to the website right now, 538.com. Keep listening to this podcast for updates as we go. And in the next few weeks, we'll arrive at a final plan.
Yeah, the lottery is May 19th, so certainly before then, we'll review our 8,000 entries and let you know who wins. Thanks, Jody, for coming in and letting us know what the next 3 weeks of your life are going to be spent doing.
All right. Good luck.
So to the NFL, on Thursday night, Roger Goodell will get up on a stage in Chicago and be mercilessly jeered for a few hours. It's an annual tradition.
Is there a commissioner that doesn't get jeered at one of these things?
There's a data analysis, right? Like, if we measured crowd volume or something.
I think Adam Silver at this point is pretty well-liked.
He's so, because of the comparison to Stern, I feel like he earned it. But then they gave him the inaugural booing last year as kind of a welcoming, just as a rite of passage.
Did they, even after the Sterling stuff, that when he got rid of the Clippers owner? That
it was
still
a loving booing, though.
Yeah, it was still a rite of passage.
Yeah, yeah.
So Goodell, I don't think will get a loving booing.
It's not loving.
No.
But you know, it's an annual tradition to, as we said, boo the commissioner. It's also seemingly an annual tradition to debate endlessly about who should be picked with the number one pick in the NFL draft. This year's debate has been particularly rich or endless, depending on your viewpoint. And from here, I'll let CBS Radio and Phil Simms do the talking.
Do you think Winston is better or a better prospect than Mariota?
A lot of answers to that, but just to make it simple, yes. Because we know there's not as many questions about the physical play than how he played and his physical attributes. It will translate to the NFL. The bad stuff, of course, you know, off the field. And the other thing is, as I have told a few people, and I don't mean to get on Jameis Winston, but he was overweight, and he had to lose weight for the combine, all those stories. To me, when you're talking about quarterbacks, that is a big deal.
So weight is something that, weirdly, 538 has looked at before with Johnny Manziel. And it was something where everyone was saying Manziel is too short, and that to be a good quarterback. And then we looked at something and showed that quarterback, it actually matters how much you weigh to be quarterback. So Phil Simms, who is the most unanalytic-minded person in football, stumbled backwards into actually saying something somewhat analytically minded, which shows me how ridiculous the draft process is, where we analyze every little thing like it's a tea leaf that actually has something to tell.
When you say that weight played a factor, do you mean that heavier quarterbacks, and I'm not talking about, you know, Jared Lorenzen from the Giants days, but
the hefty lefty.
Exactly. But do you mean that heavier quarterbacks perform better? Because usually that means more muscle and more height.
Yeah, wasn't it a positive correlation?
I think that's right, up to a point, probably. I'm pulling it up now, but you don't want to be 400 pounds. You still need to be able to extend some plays and things like that. And so, like, when you guys look at the draft, are there things that you actually think are indicative of success?
I don't. And I think we get caught thinking we've found some sort of measure for success until it's disproved or a number of players don't pan out. And then you kind of move on to the next one. I mean, even Jameis Winston, I heard, who many people think is like this surefire, can't miss prospect at quarterback, is kind of in the range of, like, what was it, like 58% probability for being a successful quarterback. Now, I don't know what the metrics are for, like, what defines success, but that number right around almost kind of what we saw, like, the Kentucky men's basketball team winning the NCAA tournament. So to think that we're talking about Jameis Winston as the number one overall pick and Tampa would be crazy not to take him, and yet the probability for success is not even up in like the 80 to 90% range.
Yeah, and you talked about us thinking that we have these solutions for being able to figure out who's going to be successful in the NFL. And they usually center around college stats, and they try to adjust for competition, and they try to adjust for system. And there's been a lot of things. Football Outsiders had a projection system that looked at number of career starts and completion percentage. And when you looked back, I think they rolled it out around like 2005, and it explained all of the previous years, you know, busts and successes for the most part. You had like Kyle Bowler, from Cal, who went to the Ravens. He had a very low completion percentage and didn't start much. And so it was like, oh, this is dynamite. And then Matt Leinart checked off all the boxes on that metric, and they're like, oh, he's going to be a star. And he was a bust. And every year it seems like you kind of do the overfitting thing that they call in statistics, where you look at what has predicted the past and you kind of, oh, well, we need to make this tweak in order to capture this one outlier. Oh, look, it fits better, and now it's going to be more predictive. And then the next year you have to add a new caveat to capture the latest miss on the system. So I think a lot of these magic bullet quarterback in particular metrics, and I don't know if that's because quarterbacks are the ones that have the most data in general. So we can't even, if we had a magic bullet system for offensive linemen, we would also probably see the same effect, but we don't even know how to measure who has been a good offensive lineman, especially in college. They're just now starting to grade on a play-by-play basis. But certainly for quarterbacks, we've seen this phenomenon of thinking that we have it figured out, not realizing what the true predictors are, and then going back and backtracking and fixing, and then repeating that every year.
But it's still pretty irresistible not to try and project it out, especially for quarterbacks, because it's such a high leverage position. And so 538, the Stats Info group at ESPN, has created a model for QB success coming out of the draft for players who are drafted in their first 4 years. And according to its calculations, and it uses all sorts of things like expected points per play and QB rating and things like that, it thinks Mariota is going to be the better quarterback. And we can make that case, and you know, we could have someone from Stats Info sitting here telling us that, but it's saying that that's the case because of the running skill that Mariota has versus Winston, for example. And it looks, for whatever reason, like it's more translatable. His ability to extend plays and rush is more translatable than Winston's in the NFL. I don't know. I mean, sure. Right. Robert Griffin III seemed like he could translate his running success pretty well. And he did that first year. And then all of a sudden, Shanahan blew out his knee twice, or whatever it was, whatever tendon or ligament was snapped. And then now what? Now we're left with the known rather than the unknown. So a lot of this seems like potential energy that's built up.
Right, and his running ability is great in the right system, just like Colin Kaepernick. His running seemed like the perfect thing for the 49ers until it wasn't, and then you're not capitalizing on that specific skill set of the player. I mean, the way I look at the NFL draft is like a bunch of lottery tickets, you know? I mean, I know people have said that too. Why would you pay, maybe you'd pay $10 for a ticket if you had certain metrics that you felt gave you a greater chance for success. But generally speaking, we have so many, like you mentioned offensive linemen, there are so many offensive linemen who have busted in the last 5 or 6 years that used to be a position where you could say, all right, well, look, offensive line is so important. Let's use this high. It's like this safe pick, and you think you have a magic bullet for what an offensive lineman in the skill set, and those numbers don't even hold up.
Right, and for what it's worth, offensive linemen, if you look back to 1980 and you use approximate value, which is Pro Football Reference's metric for player value, offensive linemen are the safest in general. They have panned out more according to, you know, producing what you would expect from the draft slot in which they were picked. But even they only do it 59% of the time when you weight higher picks, you know, more. And also, it speaks to, now that we know that certain players on the offensive line are busts with things like Pro Football Focus, and giving us a chance to actually grade these guys on more than just, did they make the Pro Bowl, or, you know, did they start a bunch of games for a team that ran the ball well. Like, a lot of, in the past, our assessments of these guys actually actually came down to a total lack of data, and it was all based on the eye test, which can tell you things, but also there, you can kind of convince yourself that, especially for guys that are drafted really highly out of college, what you saw on tape in college is still sort of the package that you're getting, and unless a guy is getting blown by, you know, with a alarming frequency, it may not be possible to actually distinguish good play at something like offensive guard versus like average versus slightly below average.
So Neil, this 59% stat is interesting because it suggests that 41% of the time, even when picking the safest position, which is offensive line, you're going to pick someone who doesn't meet expectations. Is that right? Okay. And so that brings up the question of whether or not the draft is beatable at all, right? Like, should teams have a strategy going into the draft where they think they can somehow best expectations for themselves, or is it a crapshoot? And the moment you internalize that is the moment you're freed from all the craziness and the talk leading up to it.
Well, I think what I find interesting is almost a human element of teams and GMs whose team is in a position where they're like one piece away from being great, and then other teams who are rebuilding and need to capitalize on another team being in a quote-unquote moment and possibly giving up more for a spot than the actual value of the spot, right? Because that to me is what's interesting about the draft is, like, you know, I know we're talking about the NFL, but if you look at any rebuilding team in the NBA, part of it is stockpiling picks because you know there are some teams that are going to trade you future value.
But in the NFL, it's a little different, right, Neil? There's this huge study that was done about what trading up in the draft, maybe giving away two or three lower round draft picks to get a higher round draft pick.
But that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that these teams are willing to sell value that actually legitimately is better in the long term for a key player that might be the difference for them right now.
Right, yeah. But and that key player, though, is still an unknown, right, because they're still drafting him, not knowing.
I'm talking more of like a trade.
Got it.
Right. In a weird way, the whole reason we have a draft is to sort of help competitive balance. And the reason that we let the worst teams pick first is to give them access to the best talent. But
it sounds like you have an entry for our NBA how to pick the draft thing.
Yeah, well, it's not the wheel, for instance, because if the point is to redistribute talent, then why even have a draft at all? Why weight it toward teams that are the worst? Why not just randomly distribute the players, which is sort of what the wheel does, but that's kind of a digression. Thinking about the NFL, you see teams like Belichick and the Patriots are the really go-to example for this of trading down in the draft and being able to pick up those guys in like the second and third round, maybe second day guys that actually deliver that surplus value. And there have been studies, a famous one was done by Massey and Thaler, who are these great economists. About 10 years ago, they wrote about surplus value under the old collective bargaining agreement, and they found that the top picks were wildly overpaid relative to the production that you'd get, especially in the first few years of the contract when you're paying them, and that the best value was in the second round, right around like early to mid second round. But you would think, since the NFL overhauled the CBA a few years ago after the lockout and all that, that they changed the structure of the salaries for rookies. And so rookies at the top of the draft were paid a little bit less relative to their veteran counterparts. You'd think that that might make it make more sense for you to draft high in the, you know, have a high pick. But it turns out to not be true. It's still, they're paying market value for things. And in the NFL, when you have a hard salary cap, it's in your best interest to pay below market value. And that's what you get in that second and third round.
So does that mean that the Bucks should... Sorry, go ahead, Kate.
I was going to say, for the Patriots, they have the added bonus of not having to chase a quarterback.
Exactly.
And so they've got this one position locked down. You look at the Washington Redskins, they've drafted 9 QBs since 2000. They're constantly chasing the one guy. And so it makes it so much easier for teams that have an elite level QB to say, you know what, I'm trading down, I'm going to get 3 guys instead of 1, because you have elite players at the elite positions already.
Right, that's the irony of the fact that the draft is supposed to help the have-nots. It actually kind of helps the haves, because, like you said, if you're not going for the home run on a quarterback, you can kind of play these percentages and build slowly and add those missing pieces with those second and third round picks. But if you're a team in desperate straits and you've just gone 2-14 and you really need a franchise-changing player, you're not going to get that in the second or third round. And that's why I think you see these teams kind of continually go to the well, and they take these quarterbacks and they turn out to be busts, and then they continue to be awful, and then they just go through this cycle, whereas a team that is maybe a better team can afford to stockpile and trade down and get those second-round picks.
Yeah, it's almost like the system has created them to be able to prey on these struggling franchises.
So then should the Bucks trade their top pick for way down, right, and prey upon another franchise that's desperate and build up in this way that we're talking about?
That's what the numbers say
that
you should do.
Right, but that's what the numbers say would give you the most quote-unquote value, but it's like if you don't have an elite QB and you're sitting there and there's the possibility of a guy like Jameis who might be an elite QB, then you're also not having to – you already have the number one pick. You're not trading a bunch of assets to move up for it. You have it.
Right, and so – but so, Neil, you wrote last year, no team can beat – the draft, the NFL draft. And so I'm just trying to square that with what we're talking about here, which is like, does that mean that over time you can't beat it? Or in the Patriots case, as you said earlier, like there, if the Bucks, for example, traded down now and for the next 5 years just stockpile the picks like the Patriots did, could they beat the draft? Or is it that teams aren't good at being the draft and that's why no team
can
beat
the draft?
When
you say that they can't beat the draft, we mean, at least I understand it to mean, we can't evaluate talent and know who's going to be a sure shot. Now, there's a strategy to attacking the draft and seeing what franchises will give you more long-term value and picks that a lot of franchises are really, really good on. And in that way, you can beat the draft in terms of getting more value over time, but I don't think you can beat the draft in terms of being like, this is the guy, these numbers say he's going to perform in this way.
Right, yeah, it just means that no team has a persistent ability to get better players after adjusting for where they pick than the overall average. Like, of course, the number one pick on average in the history of the NFL plays better and has a better career than the number 64 pick, but no team is consistently able to say, well, I have the 64th pick, but I'm really good at evaluating talent, and I'm able to get the kind of production that you would expect from the 30th pick with the 64th pick, and I'm really good at that. That's my thing. No team, I mean, there may be like two or three GMs in the past like 30 years that have shown any kind of persistent ability to get more than their money's worth after adjusting for where they were picking.
Okay, so let's leave our conversation of the NFL draft there, and now a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. You know the feeling, you're sitting there at the stadium looking at all the people who are at the same game as you, wondering how much they paid for their tickets. It's the kind of doubt that can gnaw at somebody. And they have what is essentially the same seat as you, but they may have gotten it for much less money. SeatGeek can help with that. It harnesses all sorts of data to give you a range of ticket prices, aggregating tickets from every major ticket site online and taking into account historical ticket prices, the day of the week, who the opponent is, etc. This week, you can use promo code TAKEDOWN on the SeatGeek app and get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the app, enter the promo code before you buy your tickets, and SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. That's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports this April. On Saturday night, Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather Jr. will step into a ring and have the boxing match of the year, of the decade, of the century. Depends
the
on
the universe's history.
Exactly.
Apparently.
It's going to be anyone who's been following sports this week or in the last week has really seen it, to me, blow up even more than I thought it could. We have the fight's going to have a record $13.2 million in sponsorship. The last record was like $5 million or something like that. Tickets are going for an average of $9,000 to be in that little arena. And it's $100 to watch it in HD, $90 to watch it in non-HD. I think they just do that to make you feel better about paying that.
Who's
as much as
you are. Who's watching
this
fight in non-HD?
Right. It's like, I don't need to see the sweat drip, the blood fly. And so the hype cycle has been, to me, really remarkable. SportsCenter is live from Las Vegas all week. HBO produced an hour-long documentary that was part behind-the-scenes look at the road to the fight and part commercial. And so let's take a listen to the closing moments of that documentary now.
You wouldn't want to ponder a world without fighters. there would be so much less to intrigue you, so much less to inspire you. There would be so many fewer great stories to tell. All legendary fighters have the same simple way of rising to the top. They do the same things over and over again. It's how they cultivate their gifts. It's how they identify purpose in such a violent craft. It's how they tell everyone else who they are. So really, all along, this was the only possible culmination. Yeah.
They do the same thing over and over again, in Floyd Mayweather's case, like abusing women. So is that HBO documentary deluding us, or is it deluding itself, into thinking that boxing is still this mythical idea that is an expression of heroes or sort of a narrative of conquering above all?
Well, was boxing ever that? I know you have some polling data on boxing being people's favorite sport, and I think, like a lot of people, I thought, oh, well, it was probably at its peak in, like, the 60s with Muhammad Ali, and that, or maybe even the early 70s, and that it was a big-time sport on par with some of the other sports, but that actually isn't the case, right?
Yeah, our polling guy at 538, who usually handles political polls, so I think this was sort of a thrilling little research task for him. Harry Enten found that when Gallup asked whether boxing was someone's favorite sport, 3% said it was in 1960, 1% in 1972, 2% in 1981, 1% in 1992, 1% in 2004, and 1% in 2013. So there's not even a trend there of boxing's declining popularity. It just isn't that popular. Or rather, it isn't people's favorite thing. That's what this is showing.
Right. And even that HBO clip saying that boxers do this repetitive thing over and over again, like, that's actually what all athletes
do sports.
To get, like, it's sort of a ridiculous insinuation that boxers are somehow separate because they've repeated this one action many, many times. Like, that's how you get good at all sports. One of the many things that was ridiculous in that HBO take, which I thought was ironic, came from HBO, since, to me, HBO and pay-per-view is part of the reason why boxing's popularity, and not whether it's somebody's favorite sport, but popularity has declined. And I think we have this storyline that we've told ourselves that somehow the American public has shied away and turned its back on boxing out of some moral ground or a distaste for the violent nature of the sport. But really, the reality is, if you look back at the numbers, it's because, one, boxing is not good for TV because you can't predict the length. The corruption is tough for sponsors to get behind, or how corrupt the sport was. And boxing went off of prime time and went to this sort of pay-per-view model a long time ago. So it's not about the violent nature of the sport. It's about the TV dollars and the lack of TV dollars.
Right. And so what's especially strange for me is that it still holds this place in American consciousness. And I've been thinking all week about why, and I can't figure it out. Like, is it that it's two people basically not wearing any clothes, whether it's men or women, right? That the people are stripped down, basically. And it's sort of this brutalistic Coliseum style thing. We don't have much of that anymore. Now, the rebuttal to myself is we have football, and that's hugely popular. And so, like, what is it that's grabbing us?
I think it's very similar to why we love seeing somebody run the mile or the marathon, because it's stripped down and from, you know, having a ball and all these guidelines and set rules and teammates. I think there is something very authentic to the idea of fighting being one of the first athletic endeavors that humankind partook in, and I think there's a lot to that. I think there's also some sort of nostalgia, I don't know why, for like the Great Depression era and how this whole pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality that I think we apply to fighters now. And possibly it's correct in terms of a lot of fighters do kind of adhere to that storyline of themselves, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps. So I think there's a lot at play there. There's a lot of Hollywoodization of boxing, even though we only pay attention to it like once every 5 years.
Yeah, there was a story about boxing movies are certainly not in decline. There seems to be many, Rocky in and of itself. But after that, many movies made about boxing seems to be somewhat out of proportion with the actual popularity of boxing relative to other sports.
So we love boxing movies. We just don't love boxing.
Well, but I should say I've been to one boxing match in my life, and it was in a rundown part of Portland, Maine, like back alley.
I always
industrial
think of Portland,
warehouse.
Maine as
I
like
know,
a
yeah.
boxing hotbed.
And guys, I'm telling you, I'm a pretty pacifistic dude. I walked in a little anxious about it. Within 90 seconds, the blows stopped registering, and I was overtaken by the awe of watching raw athleticism power just go at one another. It was really it is a compelling sport when you sit down and watch it, but it doesn't seem as though it seems as though there's a gap between what it's as we're saying here portrayed to be and what it actually is.
And I think one reason why it's so interesting to people is because the storylines aren't usually complicated. You know, I mean, you don't have a whole team and you don't have all these crisscrossing storylines like we have in the NFL. We love when things seem black and white, and that's what boxing hits hardcore in its messaging all of the time, is like placing one guy over here, one guy over here, in a very distinct playing to a persona. And in this case, it is very much being played up as good versus evil. Now, if there could be a more simple storyline than that, I can't think of one, than good versus evil.
But the irony of that is that the outcomes of a lot of these matches, especially the high-profile ones, often are gray. There's been like many inexplicable, technical knockouts and situations where it seemed like one guy won to everyone in the whole arena, and then the judges picked someone else. And really, unless a fight ends in an actual knockout, there's always going to be this element of confusion or arbitrariness of, who won and who lost that you don't see. As every other sport is moving away from that, you start to see, hockey puts in the loser point, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, instead of ties, because they want to have that decisive outcome at the end of a game. And boxing seems to be, in some of the most high-profile fights over the past few years, it has been anything but decisive.
And I think that's part of its decline is, I think you're sort of insinuating or alluding to the fact that it has had the reputation of being fixed at various times, as well as the gray outcomes, which could have been produced by a very even fight. But a lot of times, the outcome of boxing matches does not match what we have seen, which leaves you tainted as a viewer. The next time you tune in, you're going to question the authenticity of what you're watching.
I want to get at this good versus evil narrative a bit, and it's Manny Pacquiao, congressman for the Philippines, versus Floyd Mayweather, who, and I especially want to examine the evil here in Floyd Mayweather, because it seems as though leading into this fight, until this week actually, I read more about Floyd Mayweather's mouth guards and his personal chef than I did his domestic violence record. Was that your impression too, Kate, that we were sort of slow to integrate the violence in Mayweather's past into the narrative hyping this fight?
It was a slow boil. It felt like that. I remember, a year ago, as the first inclination, not the first, but one of the many cycles of will this fight ever happen, talking about Floyd Mayweather and somebody saying, well, his whole domestic violence record. And I didn't in that moment. And I think that realization has come for a lot of people over the last few weeks, correct, rightly or wrongly, right? I mean, a lot of people will say now, well, this has been his record for 10 years. So why do you care about it now? Nothing new has happened with Floyd Mayweather over the last 2 weeks. So why do we care about it now? Well, the truth of the matter is that a lot of people just weren't paying attention to boxing or didn't know.
But we also care about it now because the stakes are higher now.
Exactly.
Because if you say that something's the boxing match of the century or whatever is being said, then now is the time where that stuff matters more than ever. And even if it's old news, it's still part of someone's background. And if they're going to do an hour-long documentary about how Floyd Mayweather always knew he was going to be a boxer, right, and his grandmother was the one who believed in him when no one else would believe in him, then you also need to cover the ugly parts of his background.
Yeah, and Mayweather's the one who signed up for this fight in the middle of a social moment when we were talking about domestic violence in a way we'd never had before. So hopefully somebody was pointing out to him that if he signed up for this fight as it approached, his record would be – his domestic violence record would be under scrutiny. So I think there's that part, and there's also the part that we've dealt with within sports media, I think, which is – a lot of people speaking about Floyd Mayweather and his domestic violence record are very uneducated about the issues. And I think you would never come to the table in sports media and we'd want to talk about the NBA playoffs and you wouldn't know what was happening. You wouldn't be like Nets versus Hawks and like, oh, who plays for who? What round is that? You couldn't come to the table like that. People in sports media have come to the table with very uneducated opinions, which have then left them to only use stereotypes to speak about it because they don't actually have any valid opinion for themselves. And I think we've gotten in trouble talking about that piece of it, not speaking about, like, speaking about it smartly. Because, of course, you have to talk about the fight because that's going to be on TV. You also, if you're going to talk about the fight in an educated way, you should educate yourself about the issues that go into what Floyd Mayweather has been convicted and been to jail for.
And so, speaking about it smartly, so we have a piece coming up on 538 later this week about Floyd Mayweather's domestic violence record versus what else has been in the news, which is the domestic violence record of those in the NFL. And Floyd Mayweather in the last 10 years has been arrested 5 times, maybe depending on how you count it, you could say 6 for attacking women, and 5 times arrest, 1 citation for shaking a female security guard. So if you can call it 5 or 6, but regardless, the average NFL team in that period had 3.3 arrests on the team. So he is, depending on how you count it, almost double an NFL team over the last 10 years. And so when we think about, you know, what he represents and the conversation we just got done having with Ray Rice, then it seems to me like you have to talk about this stuff if you're going to be sort of honestly reporting on the arc of domestic violence in sports, especially in men's sports.
Yeah, and it's especially problematic in boxing, I think, because you do have this long lead up to the fight where you have to talk about things, and it traditionally, even as we saw in that HBO clip, it lends itself to these kind of gauzy human interest aspect, and the human interest aspect in Mayweather's case is his record of domestic violence and violence against women. And so think about the NFL, like the 2 weeks leading up to the Super Bowl, you always have scandals emerge and people have to have something to talk about. Now multiply that by however much time has been since this fight got announced, and that's a big reason, I think, also.
Or think about something outside of sports, think about politics. I can't tell you the number of stories I've read about the prospective presidential contenders' diets, about how I think Jeb Bush is on paleo, how Mike Huckabee has to slim down, or maybe he won't because he'll want to be the common man again. And so that's something that has a year and a half worth of storyline before action actually starts to happen. And it's a similar kind of thing. When we make space in the media to talk about something, then something has to fill the space.
Totally. And I think so much of the space has been filled by his mouth guard being $25,000 and, you know, the money team around him. And then all of a sudden, there was this cry for, whoa, you're missing a huge piece of the story. But a lot of people not being equipped to handle and fill that gap in any sort of smart way. And I think in the absence of a lot of knowledge about the issues and how to talk about them, we've kind of been all over the map about the Floyd Mayweather thing. Like, people have said, you know, if you watch the fight, it's equivalent to supporting domestic violence, and boycott the fight if you have any sort of like moral standard. And those, to me, that's the equivalent of being like, write your congressman. You know, you're not giving anybody any interesting new way to think about this or any insight to it. And I think there's this huge opportunity with the Floyd Mayweather fight and in this last week and this week, in the same way we had an opportunity with the Ray Rice situation in the NFL. Like, let's not get into the nitty gritty of Ray Rice. Let's talk about the NFL's history and what they represent culturally. And we have this moment in boxing if more people would at least be educated enough to talk about it in a way that doesn't alienate people.
Right. And the tricky thing, though, is, and this maybe gets back to the same point, ESPN the magazine this week has Floyd Mayweather on the cover with the label unbeatable. And so, you know, all of a sudden we get into really weird, tricky territory, because if we start to use the traditional verbiage that we usually put on an athlete, an undefeated athlete in this case, we evoke these ghosts of his past that are, even when we're not talking about them, peeking around the corner, right? Unbeatable while he beats women. So, like, what are you going to do about that?
Yeah. And the week before, Jameis Winston was on the cover of the mag. So these back-to-back weeks where I don't know that we know how to talk about it in a smart way, so you end up with these polarizing viewpoints.
So I differ there. I think we do know how to talk about it in a somewhat smart way in certain corners. But I don't necessarily think we know how to let that talking, or the smart way to talk about it, be the main narrative in a mass market way, right? So you're still going to say unbeatable because that's what we're thinking about going into the fight. How do we elevate the other stuff to be the hook that draws people in, as opposed to the sports achievement being the hook that papers over the domestic
violence? How do we intertwine his reality with him being a great fighter
and still sell magazines or get people to tune in? Yeah.
And the sports angle of it, you know, the NFL speaks for itself as the most popular sport in the country, and the Super Bowl and big playoff games do pit the best teams against each other. But I think it's still kind of an open question, as much as a lot of the talk has been about, oh, these are the two best boxers, probably pound for pound of their generation, and they're facing each other. This is, by definition, the biggest boxing match in years. These guys are well past their prime. Like, it's not a case of the Seahawks playing the Patriots, to take a football example. Mayweather's 38 and Pacquiao's 36, and these guys, if it had happened a few years ago, then it would have actually been a legitimately, you know, as big a deal as the Super Bowl of boxing or something like that. And that's how it's going to be treated, don't get me wrong, this week, and already has been treated. But I think the fact that it's almost like we're making a big deal out of the fight itself and the implications of it is perhaps, you know, not recognizing the fact that these guys are in some ways shadows of who they used to be.
And part of the reason they'll be able to get away with that is because the average fan who's tuning in does not know how to look at boxing in a way where I would even notice that Floyd was past his prime or Pacquiao. Like,
an uppercut's an uppercut.
Yeah, I think in the NFL or in the NBA, you know, if right now we had, like, the if Garnett was still on the Celtics and we had them playing, you know, the Spurs, and people were saying these are the two amazing, like, up and comers who are going to dominate the NBA.
Right, Garnett versus Duncan.
We would all flag that and be like, wait a second, this basketball is not in the space where we know it can be, but we don't know that.
But would we still flag it if Garnett and Duncan were the only two big men left in the NBA? I mean, part of the issue here is that there are no rising stars in boxing that, at least I know, that has gone mainstream enough for me, the non-boxing fan but sports fan, to hear about. And so that's part of the reason why it's 5 years too late but still a huge deal, is because there's no one else left.
Right, so it's not necessarily the best fight of the century. Maybe it's just the most marketable fight of the century.
Or the last gasp of boxing in this century or something, yeah. Okay, let's leave the conversation about boxing there and move on to talk about how athletes go broke. And for that, we need a special guest, Pablo Torre. Hi, Pablo.
Hello. I'm not quite as special as you may think. But
for us, Pablo.
Glad to hijack your podcast.
I think we talked about you maybe even in the pilot that no one's ever heard of Hot Takedown, about your piece on the Sixers general manager.
Yes.
And those tapes were obviously burned and incinerated and never will be.
It seemed like he may have done the burning himself.
There's a little bit of that. Yeah. But
he was heavily quoted in that, if I remember.
So, Pablo, we should say that you are a senior writer for ESPN, ESPN the magazine, all corners and crevices of ESPN. and we asked you to come on to talk about some new research into how often players go broke after they're done playing in the NFL. And in 2009, you wrote a great piece for Sports Illustrated called How and Why Athletes Go Broke, clear enough. And that was later adapted into a 30 for 30 documentary on ESPN. It's had a long lifespan, and here you are to still talk about it again. Do you remember what you wrote 5 years ago?
I do remember what I wrote 5 years ago, but simply because I looked it up before I walked into it. No, I do. I do, because it is one of those pieces that has been more resonant than I ever anticipated, because this was one of those things. The little background on how I wrote that piece was, it was the first really, really long piece I did at SI, and I had worked on it for months and months and was kind of collecting string. And it was one of those things where you become such a really wonky person about this particular intersection, financial health and retired athletes, and specifically NFL players. So for me, this has been actually at the front of my brain for
So what did you find 5 years ago?
Yeah, 78%, the statistic that the Enber paper that we'll get to mentioned, 78% of retired NFL players within 2 years are either bankrupt or under financial stress from joblessness or divorce.
Within 2 years of leaving the league.
Correct.
So we celebrate these guys for whatever reason. They slip away from the NFL. And if we did a where are they now within 24 months, nearly 80% of them, based on what we found 5 years ago, would have filed for bankruptcy already.
Or under financial stress.
Sorry, okay.
From joblessness or divorce. And that's an interesting distinction, because what it means to go broke is more than just simply having a piece of paper at a court system that says this person has more liabilities than assets. It's in fact a certain sense of economic well-being that, as you were alluding to, a supermajority certainly of athletes in most sports, but certainly in the NFL, it's bad. It's what has been referred to me specifically and to others as, you know, a financial, you know, kind of pandemic among sports. It's that serious. This is something that the leagues and the unions have all consistently failed their players on.
And so recently, though, new research came out.
Yes.
That,
yes.
Unrelated, and we'll get there, unrelated to your research, that looked at the current state of financial stress for retired NFL players. Is that right?
Well, what they did was they looked at a certain range, a time frame. And I'm gonna read from the Enber paper, if I could do that, just because.
So when we say Enber here, it's the National,
Bureau of Economic Research. Absolutely.
And these papers are floated, basically, and aren't necessarily peer-reviewed or legitimized. These are like
they're not working paper,
progress,
not
right.
Not peer-reviewed, not fact-checked to make the translation to journalistic language. The premise is that, you know, here's what we're working on, and because Enber is this great respected source, it oftentimes shapes how other people then think about these issues. But I can give you the actual summary from the paper itself. And what they did was, and this is a deep breath, they compiled a list of 892 players who were drafted by NFL teams from 1996 to 2003, and whose entire careers began and ended between 2000 and 2013. And then what they then did was they entrusted a commercial background check service with scanning for bankruptcy filings that matched up with the full names and addresses on that list. So they had this list of NFL players, all of them drafted over a very clear amount of time. And then they got some other background check service, like what I imagine I got when I had to rent my apartment. And they had them feed all those names through some database, and they cross-checked, and they came up with a statistic. And their statistic, their big statistic, was that 15.7% of these particular draftees have filed for bankruptcy within 12 years of retirement. And then, sorry to be the narrator here, but what they then did, and this is why I'm here, because I'm going to start a gang war with Enver. They said, the result of our comprehensive research on bankruptcy risk among NFL players is quite different from a widely cited Sports Illustrated article, which reported that 78% of former NFL players are bankrupt or under financial stress within 2 years of retirement.
I think I read that article.
Yeah. It rings a bell.
So the key nuance or distinction, right, is what does it mean to be bankrupt / under financial distress?
Absolutely. So
what did you find?
Yeah. So look, parsing that sentence is kind of like an interesting lesson and a microcosm of how we interpret academic research and maybe how we bridge the gap between anecdotal stuff and empirical stuff. So the two phrases that I'm going to ask us to consider, number one is comprehensive. Number two is among NFL players. And actually, there's a third one I'm going to throw in there. And quite different is a third one. And actually, let's put a fourth one in there. How they actually quoted my story, which is bankrupt or under financial stress. And so we can sort of go down the road of figuring out what is it about those phrases that kind of maybe set light bulbs off if you're actually really taking this with a fine-tooth comb. And the number one thing, comprehensive research among NFL players. So if we rewind the tape to what I just said, this is the sample that they used. 892 men drafted in the NFL. Drafted. So their comprehensive sense of the NFL is based off of draftees from a very particular time period. You may ask, how many players in the NFL were not drafted? And that would be a good question, because according to Elias in 2013, 31.4% of players in the NFL were not drafted.
So there, the sample is affected already of who they're.
Absolutely,
and you would imagine undrafted skewed. Players would not already have automatic, you know, guaranteed. Or
they might
some
have more financial
guaranteed.
Distress,
yeah.
Right?
Absolutely,
and
that's
they have
the next.
Made less money in their NFL careers, I would imagine.
Yes, and so the question is: here we have some research that I think is really interesting and valuable. And by the way, I want more research. I've asked for more research. That's why I wrote the story in the first place. That's why I'm very excitedly talking about this subject. But how we sell that research and what it means, because again, if it's going to shape the economic thinking of a population of people, let's actually get down to what this is actually telling us. So comprehensive research on NFL players, shaky.
Not as comprehensive as you might want it to be.
As comprehensive. And then the next line, which I had mentioned, right? Bankrupt or under financial stress. And so the reason why my statistic had that very long and kind of, you know, to some boring and forgettable thing about joblessness or divorce is because, as Kate was alluding to, being broke and being in poor financial health is more than simply having a bankruptcy filing. In fact, it's really difficult to find out what it means to be broke. It's a very personal, specific, relative question. We all have encounters with personal finance in our lives. So the question is, how do we measure that in any sort of mass kind of accounting of a population of people?
And there seems to be a larger question beyond just this case, which is, how are we to know which statistical numbers to trust and which not to trust? And
absolutely.
That seems especially crucial for our podcast, where we're citing stats all the time. And Neil, you deal with these data sets all the time.
Well, Neil brings them, so they're vetted.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
Neil
has a laptop.
He's right.
He has to be right.
Yeah, and especially in a situation like this where it seems so political, where one data set, its finding seems to point to, oh, well, the league is doing a good job of taking care of its players after they've retired, and so let's move on and look at something else. There's nothing to see here. But your finding suggested that the league is actually, and the union, as you mentioned earlier, they're not even helping their own members in their retirement because presumably they've moved on to the current crop of players. And we've seen that also in just dealing with the health of retired players.
It's the same dynamic. Absolutely. Right. Like, what are the incentives for actually caring about the personal finances of your employees once they're gone? Right. Like, what is the PR scandal if retired players lose their money or are not succeeding financially in the ways that they were, you know, effectively promised by this dream that they're being sold as NFL players?
So let me play devil's advocate, though. Is it the NFL's responsibility to worry about the financial health?
There is a very interesting ethical conversation, right? Does Walmart have an obligation, right? Does Walmart, if I'm working for Walmart, should they be messing around with my portfolio? You can argue that, in fact, there is an obligation for them not to do that in some ways. But at the same time, again, like, if you're going to run a financial literacy program, as the NFL has done, and basically watch it fail repeatedly, and the NFLPA, which has its own background check service, a registration program for financial advisors that has resulted in hundreds of millions of dollars being lost by players who have gone with those advisors who were registered. That's incredibly problematic. And the statistic, the 78% statistic, I want to note, I did not conduct a study. I'm unfortunately not an economist, but where that number came from was I had multiple sources in the league and in the union attest that this is the last best estimate that we've had. It was at a confidential meeting. They put it on the board. This is what they told us. And so I had those people confirm that number to me. It's been circling around. The NFL and the NFLPA in the 6 years since it was published have not dared to publicly refute that number, which I think is also quite telling.
It's also telling that we've been living with that number for 6 years, and this is the way that statistics sometimes have a very long half-life.
There are better numbers. Like, this is an imperfect number. Like, I want to have the full breakdown. I want a PDF. I want an Ember research paper that actually really is a direct analog to this, if you're going to call it out, because right now what it's doing is diminishing the importance of that. And getting back to the idea of a bankruptcy filing being an exclusive proxy for financial health, it's a binary proposition. Either you have a filing or you don't. Is that really how we're going to boil down someone's economic life? Like,
and it's kind of an extreme point.
It's the most extreme.
It's the most extreme.
And it's public, right? It's publicly filed. And so one of the things that you find out, and this is maybe where journalists and academics maybe need to meet in the middle. If you talk to athletes, and you talk to athletes who pay men to advise them on finances, what they will say is, these guys know to avoid bankruptcy at all costs. It may be the only thing they know to avoid, because they know that headlines are going to come, the media is going to come. As soon as you file for bankruptcy, that's, as they found out, quite easy to just hire somebody to cross-check and discover. So the idea is sort of more complicated than that.
I'm assuming you do have an idea of this number, but what's the general population's percentage of filing for bankruptcy? If we're looking at that number at 14% of NFL players who were drafted during a specific
almost 16% within 12 years.
Right.
To do it. I don't know what the rate is. I wish I did, and that's the number that is on my computer in my backpack right now.
Helpful
to everybody. But, you know, like, so the reason why we throw in joblessness or divorce, to get back to that thing that I mentioned before, the reason is because you try your best to triangulate, right? Like, how can we possibly get our arms around this situation. And it's honestly like problematic for me as a journalist who's reported on this to have somebody call out my work. In general, that's a thing. But specifically about this, because they are now trying to sell the public, oh, this is the better number. It's not that bad. When if I, again, this is like the analogy that I will use. If I told you, right, that like 78% of human crash test dummies, okay, human crash test dummies are dead or within medical stress within 2 years of retiring as human crash test dummies. And a study comes out and they say, actually, we studied exclusively fatality risk and we found that the number is only 16%. Like, what about the part about the full body comas? Like, right. What about that?
There's a correlation being made between, like, concussions in the NFL.
Absolutely.
You know, if you just said concussions that were reported versus how many NFL players have had subconcussive states or concussions that
absolutely
they didn't tell
it's
anybody
a spectrum
about.
It's a spectrum.
It's a very similar correlation
to me. And this
is the
trick of doing data is we rely often on self-reporting. The self-reporting in this case would be bankruptcy where you're not quite self-reporting, but you're getting to a point where
you are voluntarily at least admitting publicly.
Right. And so I think we should leave it there because Pablo's going to write a piece on 538 later in the week that gets into some of these issues. And so if you're interested in reading
more.
Yeah, I mean, if you're interested in reading more, not just about this case in particular, but about these larger questions around what numbers, how do we trust numbers, and in this instance, sort of what the pitfalls of floating a study out there might be. Because we should say, I'm not sure we can ascribe full agency to the researchers here yet because this isn't a vetted study in any way. This is sort of a work in progress.
Absolutely. But the conversation and where it goes about those numbers is absolutely something that should resonate beyond this particular topic.
Right. Great, Pablo. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, guys.
Once again, Pablo Torre is a senior writer for ESPN the magazine. And again, keep an eye out for his piece at 538.com. It's going to be a fun one to read. I've already seen a rough draft. As always, Allison McCann is here to bring us home, the home stretch of the show. Allison, what do you got for our significant digit this week?
Hey, guys. This week's significant digit is -14.7, and that's the points per game margin that the Toronto Raptors sort of disappointed us. 14.7 points per game that they scored less than we expected them to in the playoffs as compared to the regular season.
So we're recording this podcast on Tuesday, so these stats are as of Monday night's games. And so the Raptors then have scored basically 15 points less than projections would have suggested them to do.
Right.
And this is the second year they flamed out in the playoffs, right, Neil?
Right, yeah. According to this disappointment index number, they actually were also last year's most disappointing team of the playoffs. So
hang that one up. 2 years running.
Yeah, put a banner up at the Air Canada Center.
What other teams are on this index? Is it just the Raptors?
No, so our top three this year are the Raptors, Portland, and Atlanta.
Top three being bottom three.
Yeah. Yes. Top three most disappointing, correct. So this is all framed in terms of the worst. We were curious because we wanted to see, you know, sort of what was going on with Atlanta. A lot of the hot takes were like, this here was this great team, now not so great. And it's funny because Neil actually found that they're wedged in between in the most disappointing teams. It's Toronto, who was completely swept. Portland, who is basically almost entirely
like
out of the playoffs.
10% chance of moving on.
I'll let Neil elaborate a little bit more on this sort of Atlanta's funny quirk in the disappointment index.
Yeah, so right now it's two games for the Hawks and two games for the Nets, but that in and of itself has been disappointing to the tune of 8 points per game relative to what you would expect. So that's their disappointment index. And like you said, Allison, Toronto, they're sandwiched in between two teams that on either side that have either lost, that's Boston and Toronto, or teams that are really on the ropes, that's Portland and Dallas. So right now, very disappointing playoff run for the Hawks.
The company Atlanta's keeping is worrisome, right? And I love when this happens because it totally fits the eye test. As you've watched them this postseason, they don't look like the same offense and the same team that we saw throughout the regular season. And what's interesting to me about them is that they're missing uncontested shots. So it's confusing because most of the time you'll say it's a matchup issue or some one team's defense is doing something really
against
interesting.
The Nets, it's never a matchup issue.
It's never a matchup thing. The Hawks are just missing open shots. And that's actually less concerning than if Brooklyn was doing something really special, because I can't imagine, and again, there's no, I have no evidence of this, but I can't imagine that Kyle Korver is going to continue to miss 3 3-pointers in a row and shoot 4 for 13 behind the arc when you consider his percentage throughout the year. So I have to think that this should be the most disappointing Atlanta gets, because not saying that they're going to go on and win the title, but even if they play, you know, if they do get to this point, play the Cavs, I imagine that they will get it together and show that fluid offense that we saw most of the year.
It's all the NYPD's fault because of Thabo Sefolosha.
If he was still playing,
the NYPD's disappointment index is a whole other conversation. okay, so let's leave it there for this week. As always, our producer is Jody Avergan. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes, of course. You can subscribe at iTunes.com/538 if you've just stumbled into this show. You can, and please be sure to review and rate us if you already listen, if you're about to subscribe, whatever it is, it helps others discover the program. Thanks as always to Allison for coming in. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Kate Bagan.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Thanks, Chad.
I'm Chad McMatlin. Talk to you next time.